This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
You meet the coolest and most interesting people putting together a weekly program like this, and every year we like to look back and listen again to some interesting conversations with fascinating people. Back in the spring, we had a conversation with the head of the largest teachers union in the country about labor actions taken across the U.S.
What really got the attention of the politicians is the public supported those passionate educators.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our talk with Lily Eskelson Garcia, president of the National Education Association. Then it's our conversation with Victoria Stubb, a former teacher who lived with chronic pain and an addiction to opioids. And we'll spend an academic minute meeting a giant of the civil rights movement. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. On February 22nd, more than 20,000 teachers and support staff went on strike in West Virginia, demanding higher pay and lower health care costs. The strike lasted until March 7th and resulted in a 5% pay raise for teachers. When that strike began, West Virginia ranked 48th in teacher pay. On April 2nd, the state that ranked 49th, Oklahoma, had its own 10-day teacher strike. Arizona, Colorado, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Georgia also saw job actions by teachers and support staff during the school year. Back in June, we talked about these walkouts and the future of teachers' unions with Lily Eskelson Garcia, the president of the National Education Association. That's the largest professional interest group in the U.S. with just under 3 million members. We talked about what sparked teachers across the country to take action this past school year.
This is the year of the teacher. This is the wave of activism, of passion, of excitement. And it's in our most oppressed states that have been cutting school funding for a decade. And it was finally educators saying, you know, we've tried to work very politely and tried to get you to see what it's like to have 40 kids in a classroom and no books and us buying our own supplies. And enough is enough. And they took to their state capitals and they let their voices be heard. I'm so proud of them.
Now, was this a true grassroots thing or was there union involvement?
You have to have both a strong union and you have to have the activism in the hearts of teachers. You know, you can't just have a couple of people at a meeting say, you know, let's close down schools and have everybody, you know, 30,000 people show up at the Capitol tomorrow. That's not the way it works. We really are our members. The National Education Association is over 3 million teachers, support staff, the bus drivers, the school secretaries, the counselors and librarians, the people that work in those public schools, colleges, and universities are real people. And when you have a meeting and people are crying and people are angry and people are saying, whatever we were doing to be nice in the past and just explaining what was going on in our classrooms and hoping that these politicians would hear us, it didn't work. We want to do something that will get their attention. And because they have a union, because they have a group that can say, we will contain, direct, and use this energy in a way that will get not only the attention of the politicians, what really got the attention of the politicians is the public supported those passionate educators. The public said, will you listen to these people? And that's what I think scared the politicians.
In West Virginia, that is really where the attention, they really got their attention. Was that considered, looking back, a success?
West Virginia was a very, very powerful example of what passionate individuals can do when they have a collective voice. You know, individually, those thousands and thousands of underpaid school teachers and support staff could have stood outside, you know, their houses on the sidewalk and just screamed what they needed people to hear, and no one would have heard them. It was their collective voice through their union that took those passionate hearts. And I saw reporters. I was there with those brave people. By the way, they could have lost their jobs, and they knew that. They knew that in their state, they had no right to be there on the steps of the Capitol saying, we cannot allow you to hurt our students like this anymore. We cannot allow you to hurt our profession, being paid $30,000 and have 45 kids in a classroom. We can't allow that to continue. And as reporters walked through the crowds, just putting a microphone in front of a third grade teacher and saying, why are you here? And teachers would cry and they'd talk about their students. And that was the story that was getting out to the public. The public had no idea what these folks were being paid and what they were being asked to do and the money they were spending out of their own family's budget to buy paper and pencils. And it was the public saying to those politicians, you should be ashamed of yourself. And it made a difference. It made a difference in the lives of their students. And that is what caught the wildfire. That was what the brush fire that spread to Oklahoma, Kentucky, Arizona, and beyond.
Do you see this continuing into the next school year? Are there other pockets where some teachers are going to say enough is enough?
You know, you're going to see whatever teachers and support staff, educators, what they need to do, they're prepared to do. But here's what I've already seen. We have seen legislators, and we're talking Republicans and Democrats. We're talking about governors and state legislators and political leaders, state after state, who see the handwriting on the wall. They don't actually want to be the next West Virginia, and neither do we. It's not fun. What we're asking for is for people to hear us and do something about it, and not pat us on the head, not say, oh, we just love you. Keep up the good work, and you know, that's not working for anybody, especially for those students. And so we're already seeing those political leaders reaching out to the teacher leaders and saying, we need to sit down and talk. What is it that we need? And by the way, when we go and talk to those folks, we're bringing parents with us. We're bringing business people with us. We're bringing coalitions of advocates for folks with kids with disabilities or English language learners or our dreamers. And we're bringing everybody in, and we're showing the community support for something as essential as a good, great public school in every neighborhood. And because folks are listening in a different way, because they see the power of a collective voice of professionals, they're actually saying, let's work something out. Now, isn't that a better idea than pushing people to the brink where they feel like they have to put their own jobs on the line to save public education?
Well, it's always been very easy for politicians to say they support teachers, but it's also easy for them to beat up on unions. So do you see that continuing?
It's always been amazing to me when some politician will say, I love teachers, but I hate their union. I'm a sixth grade teacher. I was the Utah Teacher of the Year back in 1889 when I was young. And I got more involved in the Utah Education Association, an affiliate of the NEA, because I had 39 kids in my room, and I wanted the legislature to do something about class size, because I was sharing social studies textbooks with my three colleagues. I got the social studies textbooks for a couple of hours on Tuesday afternoon. I mean, it was ridiculous. And it was my union that said, we're going up there and we're going to make some noise about how underfunded our public schools in Utah are. And because we did something very, very similar to what happened in West Virginia, we did that 20 years ago in Utah, we saw incredible increases. You can't do that every year, and you shouldn't have to do that every year. You shouldn't have to be that desperate. But what I knew was it was my union that was my voice as a classroom teacher with too many students to serve. And so for us, we smile when people say we love teachers, but we don't like the union, because we are the union. And we know that the only time people listen to us is when our union organizes our collective voice. That's when we're heard.
And a quick interruption here. When we recorded this interview, the Supreme Court had not yet decided the Janus case. What is the Janus case? We're about to talk about it.
Yeah, it's for your listeners, the Janus decision is what we're waiting for. In some states, in about 20 states, the state legislature requires public sector unions, like education unions, to provide services like collective bargaining for non-members. And so they say nobody can be forced to join a union, but since we're requiring this union to bargain for everybody's salary and benefits and defend the contract if there's any breach in that contract, that those unions can charge non-members a fee for those specific services. And it's up to a state legislature to allow that or not. In those states that have what we call fair share fees, they're pretty much our strongest unions. And so the Koch brothers and others that do not like unions figure that they can take away from state legislatures that right to allow agency fees. It's their hope that they can then target our members, because we have very few fee payers. Most of the folks in those states are union members, and to tell them, look, now you can get that, and you won't have to pay for it. They have to give it to you for free. There'll be some people that will fall for that. The whole thing is, if enough people fall for it, then you wouldn't have a union, and you wouldn't have anyone representing you in, say, contract negotiations. And that's, of course, their ultimate goal. So we're preparing ourselves for that attack we know is coming, where they will try and convince our members that, you know, drop your membership in your union because you can get collective bargaining for free now. We think our members will see through that lie. Every one of these job actions that you've seen have been in states that don't have that agency fee. And we have seen increased membership with that activism. A lot of those younger educators, those folks who are, you know, just got their first teaching job, going, I can see the value in a collective voice that I have in my union. And so we have no intention of silencing ourselves.
Lily Eskelson Garcia is the president of the National Education Association. Now, about that Janus case, the Supreme Court decided it in late June, deciding against the unions, saying they can no longer collect fees from non-members. Still to come, a job-related injury had our next guest living with chronic pain and, for a while, addiction. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Victoria Stopp has been active all her life. That became more difficult about 10 years ago when she suffered an on-the-job injury, which left her living with chronic nonstop pain. She has since gone from doctor to doctor looking for anything to help relieve the pain and let her continue living a fit, athletic life. She writes about that experience in her book, Hurting Like Hell, Living with Gusto. I spoke with Victoria Stopp late last winter and asked why she started writing about her pain.
I really originally did it because I was having trouble dealing with pain issues and being an athlete and being frustrated, and I really wanted to stay married. And so I thought that maybe an outlet for not complaining so much at home was to start a blog. And I did. After I started the blog and it took off for a couple of years, I was featured in Runner's World. And that really gave me the idea that there was a bigger audience than just a blog audience. And that is how the book started.
You talked about being an athlete. How much of an athlete were you?
I played soccer my whole life. I played soccer and softball in college. And then after college, I kept playing soccer in Atlanta on a women's league. And then I became a pretty big runner and started playing tennis again and different things. I just any activity, hiking, whatever.
And given your bouts with pain, you still do a lot of that, though.
Yes, I do. I have to alter everything. So I don't race anymore in running. I just run by myself so that I'm not stuck on someone else's timeline in case I don't feel well one morning. But yes, I do keep doing pretty much whatever I can.
Well, let's talk about where this started. What was your injury like? What happened there?
Originally, I was hurt working as an emergency medical technician in the back of an ambulance, and I was standing over a patient, which you are not supposed to do, and I take responsibility for that. And I was thrown a bit in the back of the ambulance, and I was holding on to the stretcher and in a very awkward position. And at the time, being in my 20s and being very healthy and athletic, I thought it was something like a whiplash injury that would just go away. I planned to play soccer the next day. I had no idea that it would start a cascade of things and that a decade later I would be here like this.
And most of the doctors, if not all of the doctors you went to, just started writing prescriptions.
Oh, yeah. That was the very first thing. You know, it was like, take this pill, take that pill, and you'll be good to go. And it was kind of like a turn me loose sort of thing with a million pills. And they didn't work.
Can you see how somebody in your situation might just take that route and that's it? It's pills for life?
Absolutely. I have fought this for about a decade now. And especially when you are in severe pain, it's very hard to say no to those pills because even if they don't really work, you can take enough to knock yourself out. And at least you're not suffering if you're knocked out. I think that one thing that we really are not talking about in our national conversation about pill addiction is why a lot of people get addicted. And for me, at least, that answer is uncontrolled pain and different things that are not funded by most insurances, like acupuncture and massage, that actually help people. I'm a big believer in chiropractic, you know, so I guess what we consider alternative medicine often is out of pocket, but the pills are not out of pocket. And so what happens is people get to where they feel like they have no option but pills, whether it's financially or otherwise. And I think that we need to do a better job of talking about what leads people to that addiction, not just what to do about it once they have it.
How did you get beyond that? How did you get beyond the pills and try to just almost craft your own recovery?
Well, right now, I recently qualified for medical marijuana, and that has helped tremendously. I have not, if there's some wood, I'm going to knock on it. I have not had to take even an ibuprofen since using medical marijuana at night. But before that, I think it was pure bullheadedness that I knew when I was on different medications, I didn't feel well, and I really often didn't feel better or they would work temporarily. And just being young and otherwise healthy and refusing to give into the temptation, I guess. But yeah, there have been years of misery. I mean, it hasn't been a simple, oh, well, I'm not going to take that and I'll be fine. It's been hot tubs, massages, chiropractic pretty constantly.
One of the things you hit on in the book, and it's something that I've talked about with a lot of people in the field, is the threat of injury for people in the medical field. It's a lot bigger than you'd think, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I've worked in multiple jobs in the medical industry, and I've also taught in a health sciences program locally at the college. And I really like to stress to my students good body mechanics and being careful and taking care of themselves, because there are so many unpredictable factors when you're working with ill people. And so many places often don't have enough staff, or there are situations you can't help it and you have to pick someone up really quickly. And it's a shame. I'm not sure how to fix that, but there is definitely a high risk of injury, I think, with any hands-on patient care, especially at the lower levels where people are often not paid well and working very long shifts. They have to do a lot of very hard work, whether that be lifting, twisting, whatever, and there's a lot of injury risk in those occupations.
What's the thing that you have found over the years that people understand the least about living with chronic pain?
I don't think anyone gets it until they feel it. And I don't think that's someone's fault for being that way. I think that's human nature, that we don't truly understand another person's issue, whatever that issue is, unless it hits us. I think that the best explanation I can give people when they want to understand it a little bit more is to think back to a time when you were either sick or injured and it ruined your week or your month and you couldn't – maybe you were on crutches for 3 weeks or something, whatever it was, that it really cramped your style and ruined your life, albeit temporarily. But that's every day. Every day is that adaptation if you have chronic pain. Every day is that waking up with a sense of – what is today going to be like? How hard is today going to be? And I think that's really hard to convey to someone if they haven't gone through it.
Again, the name of Victoria Stopp's book is Hurting Like Hell, Living with Gusto. You can read Victoria's blog at fibromyalgiaathlete.com. Since we're getting reacquainted with people today, let's meet someone you may not be familiar with at all. Howard Thurman. He's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Who was Howard Thurman? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, David Gowler, professor of religion at Emory University, discusses Thurman's influence beyond being an influence to Martin Luther King Jr.
Although he is best known as a mentor to Martin Luther King Jr., Howard Thurman played a vital role in laying the spiritual foundation for the civil rights movement in the United States, including his early embrace of Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence. Thurman published numerous books and articles, but he also was one of the most influential preachers of his day. Hundreds of recordings of Thurman's lectures and sermons remain unpublished, such as the ones found in Pitt's Theology Library. And this treasure trove yields tremendous insights into Thurman's thought and influence. In these recordings, Thurman engages with fundamental, universal realities of human experience, but he also translates those ultimate realities into practical messages for his listeners to apply in their daily lives. As Thurman wrote, "It was my conviction and determination that the church would be a resource for activists thick in the struggle for social change." Key to Thurman's understanding of the religion of Jesus is his insistence that one's personal inner transformation, such as found in the parable of the prodigal son, should lead to social action, such as found in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Thurman contends that an encounter with the teachings of Jesus, especially the parables, involves much more than just intellectual assent. Understanding must lead to concrete action in the world, because truly understanding the radical message of Jesus creates a profound moral obligation. Jesus' teachings not only challenge people to act, they demand that they act. This insight is just one example of how Thurman provided inspiration to an entire generation of civil and human rights activists, and still continues to provide such inspiration today.
That was David Gowler of Emory University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.